Okay, we will start now. Hi everyone. Thank you for coming to Dr. Gensel's third class in her series From the End of the Kingdom of Judah to the Return of Zion. Dr. Gensel, we're so happy to have you here teaching to us today. To everyone here, just a quick recap of some of the upcoming classes before she gets started. Tomorrow, Dr. Lockshin's After the Ten Commandments series continues at 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern. Shuli Mishkan's series, Sanctuaries and Sanctity, continues this Thursday with an earlier start time of 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern. More details to follow. Thursday evening brings Parshat Hashavua with Rabbi Daniel Friedman at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. And Friday brings, as usual, Rabbi Kalman Sitter class at 9:35 a.m. Eastern, and all other upcoming classes can be found on our website under the Upcoming Classes tab. So thank you all for being here, and I hope everyone has a wonderful shiur. Dr. Gensel, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. I will start with sharing the screen as usual. 1 second here, and we will start. Okay. So first of all, thank you again for being with me. We're continuing, as Leah said, in the third class of our series. We're gradually getting closer to the destruction of the kingdom of Yehuda and to the destruction of the temple today and what goes on as the 3 weeks come across. Now that we're in Tammuz, where it's already around the corner, which is why I chose this topic for these weeks. I thought, as we prepare for Tisha B'Av, our first fruit and with Tammuz, these are the appropriate chapters. So let's just briefly say that last week, we saw God's glory departing, Kvod Hashem, departing from the temple. We saw actually, which was very substantial, that there's a very detailed description of God, of Kvod Hashem, of God's glory departing from the Beit HaMikdash built in Jerusalem while the building is still built. And this is basically the I would say the basis for the dispute between the two communities, one in Jerusalem and one in Babylonia, where the people in Jerusalem still have an existing temple. And they think that nothing dramatic has changed. They've already seen 10 tribes exiled at 722, 150 years before these prophecies of Ezekiel are prophesied about God's glory leaving the temple. So as far as they're concerned, nothing really has changed. The temple building is still standing. Whereas the people around Ezekiel in Babylonia, they hear a prophecy saying there's still a building left in Jerusalem, but God's not in there anymore. And it's just temporarily still standing until it'll be destroyed. But you have to see yourselves, says God to the exilic community, as the continuation. I'll just say one more word, and I'll just say that that's what was so substantial and dramatic in the prophecies of Yechezkel, because we're talking 7 years before the temple was destroyed, 5 years after they were exiled in the Galut Yoyachin. In the last part of the class, met last week, we saw Yirmiyahu's prophecies in Jerusalem, where he's back basically backing Yechezkel's prophecies in Babel, and he's telling the people around him, you're like bad figs, the good figs are in Babylonia. And you really should note that the temple here is still standing, but it will be destroyed. And more than that, we know that he sent a letter to the Babylonian exiles telling them, build houses, marry, and you should really be praying for the Babylonian success, because that is where now you are transferred to, and God is with you over there. So we basically finished the class last week, approximately 4 or 5 years before the first temple was destroyed, and we saw the both points of view, the one in Yechezkel and the one in Yirmiyahu. I want to go back to a question that we will discuss next week, but I want to just pinpoint it because it's important to remember when we discuss it next week. When these people were exiled, we are talking about if this was approximately, Yehoyachin's exile was at 597, and we're talking about 5 years later, or approximately 593 or 592 BCE. As I said in the first time we met, we're really talking about approximately one decade after the Babylonian rise. And I had noted that that's why this is not such a big issue when we look at it worldwide. It's a big issue for us who want to know the Israelites' history. But if you look at the Babylonian rise in historic parameters of what interested the world, then this wasn't such a substantial turning point. They had just come up on top of the map. It wasn't even so clear how long they would survive. And the question how long they would survive was very, very substantial because it has to do with the question of when the Second Temple will be rebuilt. And here is what I'm hinting at when the prophet asks for how many years will this be the case that the temple will be destroyed? Or in other words, for how many years do the Jews that were now exiled to Babylonia, how many years should they expect to be living in Babylonia? The verse says in Jeremiah, Ki ko amar Hashem, ki lefi melot lebavel shivim shana efkod etchem. For thus said the Lord, when Babylonian's 70 years are over, I will take note of you, and I will fulfill you to my, and I will fulfill to you my promise to favor to bring you back to this place. So, if we're looking at 70 years, approximately, from 605, which is just now what we saw of when the Babylonian rise, we reach approximately, give or take a year to each side, because we don't count half years, we don't count months, we don't count, we can count a year twice because it depends on the system of counting, which is a dispute among the scholars. But we reach approximately 538, which would be exactly Cyrus's declaration, which rises a very large question because, as we all know, it took about another 20 years between Cyrus's declaration until the Second Temple was built. We'll discuss that next week. But the reason I'm noting this now is because we are going to be actually holding on to two substantial dates simultaneously. We'll be holding on to one date of the Babylonian rise, 605 BCE, about a decade before what we had studied last week. And simultaneously, we'll also be holding on to 586, which is when the temple was destroyed, which is what we'll see today. About 20 years in between those two dates, which will end up being very substantial because the 70 years turn out till the Second Temple was built, not from Babylonian rise, which ends at Cyrus's declaration. It actually ends up ending which is what it says here, lefi melot lebavel, when Babylonian 70 years are over, that never materializes. Instead, what happens is that our 70 years come up 70 years after the temple was destroyed. And we will come back to this when we'll ask, when and why did the returnees return? And when did they think the Second Temple would be built? But part of this question has to be understood on the backdrop of the prophetic message that it'll be 70 years from when the Babylon actually first came about. So keeping this in mind, we're going to move forward and see now that we have, if I go on from 605, which was the Babylonian rise, we have 597, we have 586, the destruction of the temple, and Cyrus's declaration at 538. I am going to be repeating these dates almost every class or every class. I see it as shlichut, as maybe my, if there's one thing I'll be glad everyone listening to this series will remember by heart when we finish, it's these years, which I think are all substantial turning points, for all of us, especially as we reach Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av. So, excuse me for being a little bit repetitive here. I will keep, mentioning these years again and again. So we are looking now at the years. This class is actually devoted to the years right before the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem and right after the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, before the Cyrus Declaration, which we'll reach to next week. So this is what we all should have in mind. During these years, the destruction of the Temple and the Kingdom of Judah was destroyed. We'll get back to that shortly. I finished last class noting that anyone who wants to prepare for this class can look at the Al Yehudu Clay tablets, and I do want to say a little bit more about them now. The reason I'm talking about them now is because if I look back at our historical timeline, they represent these years that are right before and right after the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple throughout all the years until 538. And what do they tell us? They tell us a lot about what happened to the Jews who exiled to Babylonia. They do not tell us what every scholar would really love to hear, which is how religious were the Jews in Babylonia. We really don't know that. They do not tell us anything about the rituals or the holidays. They don't tell us whether they kept Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, or Sukkot. That is something we would love to know, and we don't have any information besides what a biblical prophetic literature tells us. What these clay tablets do fill in is something that we do not know from the biblical text, which is, first of all, once where some of these Jews were located. And when you look at where they're located, I want to be careful here and not to note any or upgrade or downgrade any city, current city in Israel. But let's just imagine that you're looking at a map and this place where it says Baghdad, and next to it where it says Bavel, would be like writing, let's say, Ra'anana and Tel Aviv. And then you would look at these cities and you would say, okay, they're not thrown down as far as living in the Eilat. They're not in the Negev. They're not in the Arava. They're not in the Golan Heights. They live, I don't know, Ramle, Lod, or Yehuda, Shoham, Modin. Each of you can decide what this distance represents. What we learn from it is that the Jews that exiled to Babylonia were not the top highest society, but they were pretty well off, and they lived in a place that was not too far from the center city, and they all lived as one community. And if we go further to see what else we can learn, then we first of all know that these are Jews because they're all called Al Yehudu. They all have the signature noting that they are from the city of the Jews. And when we look at the tablets that are all a corpus of tablets, all with dates, signatures, they note who is the scribe that wrote these tablets. It's as if we found a lawyer's archive, which tells us a lot about what he was selling, what he was buying, what was he testifying to, how much property did these people own, and what standard were they living at. That's basically what we're looking at. We're looking at like a lawyer's archive with all the documents that he needed in order to sell and buy anyone who came to his office to get a consultant or to get services from a lawyer. So when we look at these documents, we know more or less what did the Jews own. We know that they had land. We know that they had property. We know that they had oxes, that some of them were selling or buying slaves. We know that they had figs, and we know that they had dates. This information basically tells us a lot about the fact that the Jews were not living in poverty. Now, if you look briefly at the pictures I chose here, then the bottom left picture basically is the way that the scholars put together the family line and through the names, and they actually really restore how the people were related to each other. The top left tablet, is, I pointed out, because it has the name Netanyahu. The reason we know that these are Jews are not only because it says Al Yehudu, but also because all the names end with God's ending, Yahu, as opposed to, for instance, the Edomites tablets that end with their God's name called Kuth. So that's already another way that we know that these are Jews. Here you can see the cuneiform text from close. You can see something else, which is also interesting on the top right, which is basically the water, the way the water went, the way the water paths. A lot of the tablets have to do with the fact who owns this water. The water, the rivers were turned to different ways, and people moved them to different, to be capable to use them in order to use for their fields. So you can see there are issues that have to do with the water courses. And you can see on the bottom right that there's also the name of the scribe that the king uses when he wants to do anything that has to do with the people that are under his control. So that's just briefly. And this I took off the internet. You can see the general information that we know about them. Their collection, about 200 clay tablets from the 6th and 5th century BCE on the exiled Judean community in Babylonia. And as I said, they contain information on the physical condition of the exiles, their financial condition, and we know that these are Jews. You can see here the dating, since all the tablets have a specific date. You can see that the earliest date back to 572 BCE. That's a little after the temple was destroyed. And the most recent tablets date back to 477. That's what people say is closer to the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Why am I bringing all this here? I will just say one more piece of information until we understand why this is substantial for us. I'll just say that one tablet on the side of it has the Hebrew name Shelmaya, which is apparently the name of the Hebrew scribe who was bilingual, and he had left his personal name on the side, probably just to note who was the scribe or who does this belong to or why this belongs to him. So in addition to the fact that it says Alim Hudu, that it has Jewish names, one of the tablets actually gives us, like I wrote, regards from Shelmaya, gives us a very direct piece of information about the fact that he was a Jew. This all is very substantial now that we learn about the Babylonian exile for two reasons. First of all, we understand that if these tablets already in 572 demonstrate that the people were pretty well off, that did not happen overnight when they were exiled in 586. That most probably was the outcome of a community that lived for at least two decades in Babylonia and made sure they had institutions and made sure that they started buying and selling and arranging for themselves a proper establishment, which was where they lived. So by the time the temple was destroyed and the Babylonian exile came about, the Babylonians exiled this second group of Jews in 586, 12 years after the first group of Jews. They basically joined an existing community that was pretty well off in Babylonia. That was the situation. And, you know, it's like, lehavdil elef alfei avdalot, but imagine that people had left Europe, 1930, 1933, 1935, 1938, and then survivors of the Holocaust would join them after the Shoah took place. So there would be a very substantial difference between these two groups of communities. There are those that left before everything was such a catastrophe, and there were those that left after 3 years of a matzah on Jerusalem, that were starving, that there was no food, after the Babylonians made it much more difficult for them. That means that the Jehoiachin exile was a strong community that was basically the foundation of Jewish diaspora Jews, and they were basically all there before the first temple was destroyed. So that's the first reason that the Al Yehudu tablets, to my mind, are so important. They add another substantial piece of history. The second thing, which will come back to be relevant next week, God willing, when we study about Cyrus, is why did most of the Jews choose to stay in Babylon? Why didn't they come back when Cyrus said, hey, guys, it's time to go to Jerusalem and build the temple? Well, we can answer that on different levels. But one level would just be that they were pretty well off in Babylonia. They had no idea what would happen in Jerusalem. And as we see from what the tablets tell us, they were doing well off financially. And Israel was not exactly an attractive place to go to when Cyrus's declaration came about. So for most people, this was not so attractive. I will add to that another important piece of information, which is why I noted before, when do the 70 years come up? If we're looking at 70 years that really end from the time of the Babylonian rise, then Cyrus's declaration in 538 makes sense. But if we're looking at 70 years from when the temple was destroyed, then Cyrus's declaration is about 20 years too early. So I don't think there's one answer, and I don't have, you know, the right answer to pull out, but I definitely want to point out here that these 50 years from that are before and after the temple was destroyed are years where in Israel the times were very hard, and in Babylonia the Jews were doing pretty well. So I see the comment about Germany, and I apologize. Maybe it wasn't a good comparison, but I wanted just to make the point. And I totally take it back if it wasn't, if it didn't come across the way I meant for it to be. But, so that's the Babylonian exile. Now, as far as the biblical texts, we have three different descriptions, if not four, of the temple being destroyed. And I want to briefly note what each of these chapters say. Let's start with the first brief description in Melachim Beit Kaf Dalet, 2 Kings 25. Let's see if the link works here. Can everyone see the Sapphira verses now? Can you see them?
We can't see them because no. I think you're just sharing your presentation.
Yeah, but let's try again because I pressed the link on the presentation. Okay, fine.
Now we can see them.
Now you can see them. Okay, perfect. I wanted to have it English across Hebrew, and putting it on the presentation made it very crowded. So I figured we'll try this. If it doesn't work, keep me posted. So we're up to the temple being destroyed. I want to say one more word. When we see different descriptions in Melachim, in Jeremiah, in Yirmiyahu, in Divrei Hayamim, and within Melachim at least twice or three times of the same event, obviously what it means is how substantial this event was in Jewish history. So that goes without saying. But that's just part one. The second part is what pieces of information does each of these books bring to us? And it's not the same pieces of information, and has to do with the purpose of each of these works. So let's start with Kings. Kings tells us, Vahi b'shana tshi'ite molcho, the ninth year that Nebuchadnezzar was ruling, b'chodesh ha'asiri, we start counting from Nisan. So if we're looking at the 10th month, we do Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei, Cheshvan, and we reach Asara b'Tevet, ba'asor l'chodesh, ba'nevuchadnetzar melech bavel, huvechol chelo al Yerushalayim, v'yichan aleha v'yivnu aleha dayak saviv. So we're starting off at Asara b'Tevet, I'm not giving here a detailed class on all the different fasts. That's a different conversation. I'm just going briefly through the main events here. V'tavoa il b'matzor ad ashtei esre shana le'melech Hizkiyahu. So we're looking at from the 9th year to the 11th year. On all, we're talking about 2.5 years. As I said, we don't count half years usually, so we round it up to 3 years. V'tish'a l'chodesh v'echazak v'rav ba'ir v'lo haya lechem le'am ha'aretz. It's interesting that it does not say which month it is. And you can see here that the translator filled in for us to know that we're talking about Tammuz. So after 2.5 years of siege, they succeeded in breaking down the wall, and the Babylonians are now within the city. They reached the king, as opposed to the king of Yoyachid that was exiled to Babylonia and was pretty well off there. We'll see soon. This king rebelled, Tzidkiyahu, which is why he's not going to get the same kind of consideration that the previous Yehuda king received. They take him before the king, which was then in Rivla. They slaughtered Tzidkiyahu's sons in front of, before his eyes. And what they did to Tzidkiyahu himself was that they made him blind. We're almost 20 years within the Babylonian rule. He burned the house of the Lord, the king's palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. He burned down the house of every noble person. And he basically left no wall around the city. ואת יתר העם הנשארים בעיר ואת הנופלים אשר נפלו על המלך בבל ואת יתר העם הגלה רב הטבחים. And many more, the remnants were all exiled. But, and this is an important piece, he did leave the poorest people within the land. Okay? מדלת הארץ השאיר. There were still people who had some vineyards, who were still farmers, who were kept in the land. It's very substantial to understand that according to our texts, the destroying of the temple was not the final moment when the land was left empty. We know that soon from Gedaliah's assassination, that there were people that were left after the temple was destroyed. And now that he tells us what they took with them, the different vessels from the temple. There's a description of the temple vessels that were taken and a few of the people that were taken, the top military people. And basically what he tells us, and here's the final note, Vayagel Yehuda me'al advato. Thus Yehuda was exiled from this land. From verse 22, the verses go on to tell us about Eliyahu ben Achikam. I want to stop here for a minute. And first I'll answer here, Ellen Stone, that there were no Jews in Babylonia before Nebuchadnezzar exiled the first lot. And we spoke about it the first class when we said that the Jews that were exiled 150 years earlier by the Assyrian Empire assimilated and did not keep their Jewish identity in exile. And I want to say just a few points to point out of the description that we saw in Kings. The first thing that I want to say is that if we only had the Book of Kings, we would know nothing about the dialogue between Jeremiah and the people in Jerusalem. We would not know how much they suffered. We would not know what happened in those final years in Jerusalem. All we would know is, within a brief description of 2 or 3 verses, that there was a siege in the city, there was a matzor, and it took 2.5 years until the walls broke down. We would know it started in the Sabbath event, and it ended, it doesn't even say Tammuz, it just says on the 4th month, so we would have to fill that in like from other sources, from extra biblical sources or other prophetic literature. And finally, that in Av, also again, it doesn't say the exact date in Av, the temple was destroyed. And here's the most important piece. And the fact that the temple was destroyed is not the final turning point, because afterwards, people were left in the city and they even had a commander. His name was Gedaliah. I want to point this out because if you think of the narrative that Ezekiel was trying to bring forth to the people in exile, he was basically trying to tell them that the temples being destroyed was not the most substantial turning point. What I want to say is that there definitely could be an understanding that the fact that the framing, I would say, that Ezekiel basically was trying to say, which was the main turning point was Jehoiachin's exile, because in the days that the temple was burnt weren't so dramatic. We already know God left the temple earlier, and we know people stayed in the land later, could be also backed by the description in Kings that does not put such an emphasis, like we hear in Yirmiyahu, for example, on the specific day that the temple was destroyed or the specific events that happened that day. And definitely does not say anything about God's leaving the temple when that temple was destroyed on Yudzayin B'Tammuz or Tisha B'Av that year. All we know is that additional vessels were taken down to Babylonia, just like we know that in the Yehoiachin exile, there were already many substantial temple vessels taken to Babylonia. So it's like another phase of additional temple vessels. Not, we can't even say that they were more prestigious or more dramatic in any way or more central pieces, because it looks like substantial pieces were taken both ways in both times. So that's the description in Kings. I'll say one more thing about it, which is the book of Kings really wants to talk about about what happened in the Jewish history of the first temple period that caused the first temple to be destroyed. That's the, I would say, a common thesis that goes throughout the book. So by the time we reach the final years, this has already been decided. And that's really what the book brings across. It does not bring a dramatic decision made by God the year the temple was destroyed, that now's the time to destroy it. I would say, on the contrary, it brings up to us an understanding that this decision was already made in the years beforehand and just materialized in these specific years. So that's the point of view of the Book of Kings. Now, I will say that it's not the only point of view. We will go back to the Book of Kings when we look later on at at the final chapters. And here you can see, again, the Babylonian exile. We looked at the Book of Kings. And now we'll look at Jeremiah and we'll compare a little bit and see what's this is the brief description in Jeremiah. There's also a detailed one. The brief one is in the last chapter. And let's just see how the Book of Yirmiyahu emphasizes things a little differently, even though this description in Yirmiyahu is closer to the one in Kings, but not identical. So here's where the chapter starts. Ben 21, do you see it? Yeah, everyone sees Jeremiah 52. Are you with me? Do you see it?
Yeah, you can see it.
Okay, thanks. Ben 21 shana Tzidkiyahu b'malcho, he was 21 when he became king, and 11 years he ruled over Jerusalem. But yes, now you can see the prophetic description of why this happened that was lacking in the Book of Kings. Notice, it's not like Yehoiachin, it's like Yehoiakim. Indeed, even though Hashem was in Jerusalem, ad shlichot ha'me'al panav, ve'imot tzidkeh ha'melech bavil. And this is a very important verse, because it kind of hints to the question of when did God actually, you can say, send off the people, or when was his presence not there anymore in Jerusalem? And you can see the commentators here give different explanations of what, when to understand the words here, ad hishlicho otan me'al panav, were a cause of anger for the Lord so that he cast them out of his presence. If we would ask Yechezkel, he would tell us that this happened in Galut Yehoyachin, which is also obvious because in the book of Yechezkel, even after the years that the temple was destroyed, Yechezkel continues to count to the Galut Yehoyachin. He does not go to start counting after the years of Galut, of the temple being destroyed, to the temple's destruction. So we understand that throughout, even 10 and 15 years after the temple was destroyed, he's still referring to Galut Yehoyachin as the central turning point of history. One second. So that's one basic, substantial difference. I apologize. Let's look now at the next verse. Just having here a hard time. This one second. Okay. Can I? Sorry. Al af Hashem hayta b'Yerushalayim, so we hit that. Vayhi b'shana tshi'it l'malcho, b'chodesh ha'asiri b'asor l'chodesh, ba Nebuchadnezzar melech bavel, hu v'chol chaylo al Yerushalayim, v'chnu alav v'yivnu alav adayek tzaviv, and in the ninth year of his region, on the tenth day, of the tenth month, King Nebuchadnezzar moved against Jerusalem with his whole army. And you can see exactly how he started siege around the city. B'chodesh ha'revi'i b'tish'a l'chodesh. Now we already see very specifically it's the ninth day of the fourth month. It's not exactly the days that we use today as Shivat Esrei B'Tammuz, but it's close enough. B'yachazak ha'ra'av ba'ir. It was already, the famine had become acute in the city. There was no food left for the common people. So here you can see a description that was lacking in the Book of Kings. We feel much more for the people. We understand they're starving. We understand how hard the situation was. You can also see here that the events are described in a much more exist as if we're there. We can really feel with them. We can see how they ran out of the city walls at night. We can see how they walked, you see, and they set out through the Arava. And the description of the king will be the same. With a comment, that Nebuchadnezzar basically tells him, you know, you betrayed me, you rebelled. This is why this is happening. You didn't sit quietly like we had agreed. And again, he kills sons. He makes him blind. And he tells us specifically exactly, v'chodesh ha'chamishi, and now we're talking about the fifth month. This is Av, Shnat 19 la'melech, ba'melech bavel. And here's the final destruction of the temple. V'yisof et beit Hashem, v'et beit ha'melech, v'et kol batei Yerushalayim, v'et kol ha'bayit ha'gadol saraf beish. So you could see here that as opposed to the description in the Book of Kings, this is described by a few more details as a more substantial turning point. Vayisrof et beit Hashem ve'et beit ha'melech ve'et kol batei Yerushalayim ve'et kol bayit ha'gadol saraf ba'esh, meaning he burned down the house of the Lord, the king's palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem, definitely does not just sound like another event similar to the one that happened 12 years earlier. But not only, also on a theological perspective, not only, like we said before, on a historical perspective. And you can see it also said here again. Again, he leaves, the people, some remnant that are left in the city. And again, also here, they're the poorest people of the land. Again, he tells us that parts of the temple were being exiled. with a little bit more of a description, and that it also included the top people. Here, there's a little bit more detail again about which of the officials were taken to Babylonia. You can see here the scribe. You can see here the top military officer. Am ha'aretz is an expression used today to say the lower class people, but in biblical terms, it's the higher class people. You can see he's talking about the main people, and he's telling us again, like in the book of Kings, thus Yehudah was exiled from its land. Now I saw someone here asking about the numbers, so I didn't answer before because here we reached the verse I wanted to point out to. It says in the chat, so it says, Zeha Am Asher Eglah Nebuchadnezzar, Bishnat Sheva Yehudim 3,023. So you can see here there's a number, 3,023. Then it goes on to telling us that there were another 832 people. And then it goes on to tell us in the 23rd of year of Nebuchadnezzar, they exiled 7,445 Judeans. The total amount is 4,600 persons. Is that the amount of people? Probably not. It's probably, and I'm replying to a question in the chat, this is probably more like counting the top officials, the high officers, the scribes, the personnel, the people who ran the things in Yehudah. Apparently, it wasn't so important for them to count the people that were the other people, because they also weren't a threat and they also weren't substantial. Now, remember, we're talking after 2.5 years of a mitzvah, a siege. Remember, and we'll see it so shortly, that some of the people flew to Egypt. Remember that they left the poor people within the country. So we really have, by now, Jews living in Babylonia, still left in Yehudah, and shortly we'll see also in Egypt. So we really, you can see how the Jews started to be spread out. It starts in 597 with a strong exilic community in Babylonia, but it continues after the first temple was destroyed, with people being left in the land purposely, and with people who flew to Egypt. One verse here we'll see. So these are the numbers given by the prophetic literature, but I don't know to tell you what the final number would be. And I can tell you scholars debate on that also. There's not one. There's no one answer. Someone pointed out here that I skipped the point of how long the siege lasted. It probably lasted 2.5 years from Tevet, okay, of the ninth year of Nebuchadnezzar, until Av, 2.5 years later, which would be the ninth year, the 10th year, and the 11th year. But we count 2.5 because if you count from Tevet until Av, so it's, so we're looking at Tevet, Shvat, Adar, and then Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av. So it's till the beginning of Av would leave us 7 months. If you're talking approximately from Asara b'Tevet till approximately the beginning of Av, then the siege lasted 2 years and 7 months. Okay, so Chazal, and we're used to just coining it as 2.5 years, as 3 years, but if you want to be accurate, again, I'm replying to a question, then we're looking at 2.5 years. I'm going to share the PowerPoint presentation again and say, can you see the PowerPoint now?
We can. Okay.
And say that I am not going into all the chapters for now in Jeremiah 33 to 40. I'll look at them next week. But I will say that there we find another third perspective, which is different from a fourth perspective that we can find in Chronicles. They all have the same major events. Nothing, you know, dramatic changes. It's give or take a date here, a few days here, a few days there. But there are different perspectives. So if we have to conceptualize the two perspectives we saw until now, we saw the book of Kings, which basically is in line of what we heard from Ezekiel, which is, yes, the temple is being burnt in these years, but it's not about God leaving a temple. It's not about the sorrow of the people. It's not about anything substantial that happened now, 586. And we saw Jeremiah, which gives us a little bit more of a personal perspective where we feel a bit more for the people. And this is a turning point that's more substantial. Now, it's clear because Yirmiyahu is really standing in Jerusalem describing the events as they take place. And you can understand that the sorrow is evident even when he's just giving a brief description, let alone when he gives a detailed description, which we'll see later next week. So I do want to say that the verses that we missed in Kings and in Jeremiah are found someplace else in the biblical literature, meaning this is what we would expect to see, let's say, in Kings, right, which doesn't exist at all. And the fact that it shows up in Lamentations and Echa, to my mind, actually helps us understand what the book of Kings is about and what it's not about. And it's not about the sorrow, the feeling that the Jews had. It's not about trying to cope with the theological questions that come about. And if you ask me personally, I think that's why these events in the biblical passages are so substantial. It's not only because they're so substantial in the Jewish history. It's because we have an amazing, I would say, experience or an amazing event that demonstrates to us why the Tanakh has to work as one whole and that no one book really gives us a good enough perspective of anything. Not of the historical part, not of the theological part, not about the emotional part, not about how the people felt. If we want to try to understand what it was like when the first temple was destroyed, then we have to look at Ezekiel, at Jeremiah, at Kings, at Chronicles, and now I'm adding Echa. Meaning, and it's not that there's one right story or one a more accurate one. It's that each book gives us a different perspective, and together there's a harmony that basically tells us a story. And that's why when we read each of these chapters or each of these books, we have to be with one ear to what's not being told or what's the perspective that's coming about. So I chose Echa Perek Hey, but other chapters were relevant too. Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Behold and fear our disgrace. Our heritage passed on to aliens, our homes to strangers. I took the verses that exactly describe the destruction of the first temple. I did not take for now the verses that describe the starvation. I did not take the verses of the people starving in the streets because I wanted really to complement the verses that we saw in King. And this is what we would accept. Gone is the joy of our house. Our dancing is turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us that we have sinned. None of this was apparent in the books that we saw, or the descriptions that we saw rather in Ezekiel or in Jeremiah or in Kings. The closest was Jeremiah. Oh, how did it look after the temple was destroyed? Because of this, our hearts are sick. Because of these, our eyes are dimmed. Al har tzion sheshamem shualim ilchu bo. Because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate, jackals prowl over it. So you can see, this is what I would expect in Kings. And the fact that it doesn't exist there really shows that it's not necessarily the case that God's departure was at that minute. So here I see Naomi Bar-Yam writes a comment about the tradition that says which I wanted to address, that Jeremiah wrote Kings and Echa, which is true. I am not sure that these books were written by Jeremiah, or at least the final edition we have in front of us, and they didn't go have any edits. Like the tradition tells us that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, in the Great Assembly, many years later, were the people who finally put to writing the edition that we have of Ezekiel now. And we see that also for other books. What I wanted to say is that it could be that these are Jeremiah's perspectives, and he himself was giving us different perspectives. But it also could be that the tradition wants to emphasize, or rabbis want to emphasize the fact that, I'll say this gently. When reading these perspectives, they're so different that one may wrongly come to the conclusion that they don't work together. That we're not just reading Haaretz and Jerusalem Post or Old Sheva. We're really reading different, not only different points of view, but we're looking at the events as if they happen in different ways. And I think that the message the rabbis tell us by deciding that Dafka, these three books were all written by Yirmiyahu, as opposed to Ezekiel, that they don't mind saying and shaking it at the Gdolah, is to tell us, yes, this is one voice of God, and it's given in three different points of view. To say that even if on the surface it may seem to contradict, we should carry the understanding or the notion that these are different perspectives of what Hashem wants us to be understanding of the fall of Jerusalem. I want to point out one more point on this chapter on Eicha, chapter Hey, the fifth chapter, which is the theological question. What we'll have to cope with from now on is what happens to God and how is God viewed? And we already mentioned it when we discussed last week the question, and 2 weeks ago, could God be in exile? And this chapter actually deals with that in a roundabout way. It says, Ata Hashem le'olam teshev kisacha ledor vador. But you, O Lord, your throne enters through the ages. Lama lanetzach tishkachenu? Why have you forgotten, forsaken us for all the times? Hashivenu Hashem elecha. Thus, take us back, O Lord, to yourself, and let us come back. Renew our days as of old. Ki ma'os ma'asta batzafta aleinu adnum. The chapter here ends, For truly you have rejected us, bitterly raged against us. I want to point this out because in our tradition, this is too hard of a verse to end with. And even in Tisha B'Av, when we read such a verse, the rabbis add to the last verse a repetition of the verse that comes before it. Hashivenu Hashem Elecha v'Neshuva. Take us back, O Lord, to yourself. Because they don't want to end with God's rejecting us, Israel. But let's, before we see how the rabbis solve the problem, stop a minute to think about what the chapter is saying at face value. And the chapter face value is not saying, Shivenu Hashem Aleicha, that the people want to be taken back. The chapter face value is ending telling us you have rejected us. Bitterly raged against us. That's the exact feeling of the people in Israel. Now I'm going to do a very sharp turning point. And I will say, I know this is a little dramatic, but I'll say it this way. The people in Israel are feeling like God's rejected us. That's it. We're doomed. And what are the people in Babylonia seeing around them? They're looking at, and here's a certification from Nebuchadnezzar Palace, about King of Jehoiachin in these years, parallel years, where the King Jehoiachin, I'll remind you, that's the one king before the king that was exiled, Kiyahu, gets allowance on regular basis for him and his staff. This is a tablet, and this is what it says. It says, on regular basis, make sure that Jehoiachin the king gets enough oil, that his sons get enough oil, and that there's enough food for the additional people that exiled with them from Yehuda. So think of the contrast here. Think of the people in Jerusalem. that just had, were starved, literally, exactly like that, starving. And then think on the contrary of the king, sorry, and a king whose sons were killed and his eyes were taken to, his eye, you know, he was made blind. And then think of the other option on the table. The other option on the table is a king that's getting, I would say, the top resources from the temple community on a regular basis, making sure that the king and his family that were exiled just a decade earlier have everything that they need. Obviously, it's a huge contrast. We really can see two different kind of, I would say, communities that get totally different attitude from the Babylonian king. One because he was with the king, one because he exiled. This leaves us really, I think, thinking about the diversity of the Jewish communities, of the Judean community. This is even before Egypt. We'll look at the community that fled to Egypt, God willing, next week. And before I open the floor for questions, I will just end and say that anyone who wants to prepare themselves for next week, I recommend on looking through the last 9 chapters of the book of Ezekiel, where we get this description of, I hope you can see the PowerPoint presentation, of Ezekiel's visionary temple, which you can see here on the left and on the middle, pictures of the visionary temple of Ezekiel. On the bottom, you can see Babylonian Ziglag. We'll discuss what that means for the people in Babylonia. I will just discuss this temple very briefly at the beginning of next class as we go on to think about the different communities. But you can already hold in mind that there's a very detailed description of the last 9 chapters of Ezekiel. And you can think, how do the different people that we talked about today address this visionary temple? Whether they're the Judeans that were exiled already in 597, whether they're the Judeans that joined them after 586, whether they're people who were living in Egypt. We have a whole diversity of communities that, as we saw, are coping with totally different situations. So that's today. I'm going to open the floor for questions. I think I answered the questions in the chat, right? Yeah. Any questions?
Thanks.
Yes, Usher.
You asked us to look at about those tablets, and you showed us the side of one of those tablets. All the tablets are written in cuneiform, which is not alphabetic. Cuneiform is not an alphabetic language. And yet, what you showed us, the signature was written in Paleo-Hebrew.
Nahon.
It was actually alphabetic. Are there more tablets which show more Hebrew? Is there any tablet anywhere which shows Ezra and Nehemiah's Hebrew writing style, which is totally different from Paleo Hebrew? And if not, where did it come from?
I'll answer briefly. Ezra and Nehemiah's writing style, I think, was cuneiform, but I know the rabbis say differently, so we can discuss what the rabbis say in the Gemara. It's not in this series, but it's a worthwhile discussion of how they wrote. I will say that this is the only Hebrew piece here. And what's interesting about it is, to my mind, is how coincidental it is, meaning, if we wouldn't see this totally coincidental scribe that left us his signature on the side of one of the cuneiform tablets in Akkadian, as you said, we would think that they probably didn't know any Hebrew, or that they didn't know alphabet, or that they forgot the Hebrew, or that they stopped learning, and the scribe stopped teaching the Hebrew language, or I don't know what we would think. But here it is, thanks to this scribe that left his name Shelemiah, we see that they were totally on top of it. So it's an interesting piece of history, which is why I brought it. And thanks for that comment. Who else is here? Someone raised their hand, but I don't know who it is. Yes, Yael.
I have a question regarding how fast the Israelites or the Judeans managed to establish themselves in Babylonia. It sounds to me like they were taken away as slaves and then they landed on their feet and were able to thrive. But that doesn't sound like a reasonable amount of time to do that.
The first group was not taken as slaves to the way that you imagine it. That's why I used the Holocaust comparison before the Holocaust events. But I would say that they were taken, and they were taken as slaves, but they were taken as top-notch people with strong capabilities. They were not starved. On the contrary, they were given their supplies they needed. And it was basically reshuffling the places where the strong people in the community live in order to make sure no one rebels against the central king in Babylonia, but it wasn't about downgrading them. I'll say more than that. It was of the main empire's interest that they succeed as farmers, that they pay taxes, that they do well off financially once they reached Babylonia, and there was no reason to think that they might rebel once they're out of their own land. So once that threat wasn't an issue for the Babylonians, which it wasn't when the Jews exiled and reached Babylonia, then they you're right, they were accumulated pretty quickly. But it was because we're not talking about a starved people. Someone here notes Danielle. I hope to reach that eventually. And mention that in one of the classes too. So I'm going to end here for today. And I hope I'll see you back next week when we continue on, starting from Ezekiel's temple and discussing the group that fled to Egypt. And finally, seeing another perspective of the description of the temple being destroyed. And we'll move on slowly but surely toward Cyrus's declaration. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.